This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. Today we read two stories from the summer 2024 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. First, She's a Rescue by Marie Vibert. Getting a dog to do what you want in zero G is about as easy as you'd imagine. I already had scratches on my arms and Fleur's little hard nails. She was wriggling every which way in the air between my hands, every way but towards the treadmill. I managed to get the first two hungee cords attached. This kept her shoulder harness within 10 inches of the treadmill, but she twisted the straps around herself, pinning her back to the running surface. She showed me her lush, tanned fur belly, chin tucked, to give me a look both adoring and joyful. How I hated her at that moment. There was a smack of metal on metal and a sharp ding and a curse as Dad banged his way through the hatch. "Juno, don't you hear that?" "Hear what?" Fleur was instantly still, attentive when her favorite human was around, and as soon as I wasn't frantically trying to wrestle her into place, I heard the beep of the comms and realized from its urgent speed that it had been going on for a while. "I gotta fix this leak. I gave you one job," Dad snapped and pushed off, sailing past us. It so wasn't fair. I had lots of jobs. I was taking care of Fleur. I was keeping the ship log. I was throwing food for lunch. I wanted to explain that, but he was already muttering to himself, "With our luck, this is pirates come to kill us." He failed to notice the coolant leak when we were packing up, and now this. Now he'd never trust me to drive the ship. It was all I'd wanted since forever. Okay, since I first saw the ship a year ago. Instead of the spheres and scaffolding of the usual cargo haulers, the paper crane was a hypersonic bullet with fins for maneuvering in atmosphere, even hitting atmosphere at the speed of interplanetary trajectories. Yeah, okay, it was out of date. Nothing ages like last year's racer, but it wasn't like I'd get to fly this year's. We took out the extra fuel tank and every other engine to make room for cargo. Dad and I did that together, and he all but implied I'd be allowed to drive. Well, when I'd asked if there was a minimum age, he'd said no, and he'd given me this look with his eyes squinched, so I knew he knew why I'd asked. But no, he chased me away from the controls, even when the ship was on the ground with its engines disconnected. He still thought of me as the 12-year-old he rescued, even though I've been a teenager for almost 2 years now. If I could, I'd curl up too tight that I'd vanish into a single point. But the dog had chilled out, and that wasn't going to last. I didn't want to get in trouble for not walking her, too. I got Fleur flipped and the third bungee hooked up. After that, getting her all the way in and the puppy VR helmet on was easy. Soon, her tail was going crazy and she was trotting away for her 20 minutes of required exercise. I unhooked my feet from the sweat-soaked floor loops and went to see who was calling our ship. Dad hadn't answered. He'd just muted the alert. He hung in the air over the glilet chair like a disheveled balloon. Before I could ask, he said, "It's your mother." Damn, I wished it had been pirates. I reached forward and tapped accept. Dad gave me a brief, betrayed glare and turned his business face to the camera. "Minerva, What brings you out here? Yikes! She was enormous, projected in front of the cockpit windows. Her always perfect hair was red again. Her lips looked like hooks made to tear into flesh. Willie. Mom used Dad's least favorite form of his name, as usual. A racing ship? Is this your midlife crisis? She sighed with pretend boredom. By the authority of Ceres Station, I am officially denying your request to land. Dad's jaw shifted, but he kept his tone neutral. Congratulations on your new position. The paper crane passed inspection and is authorized to dock on Ceres, which we plan to do in 4 hours. This is a routine cargo run. I don't care, and it gives me great pleasure to tell you to turn around right now. If that flashy garbage comes within visual distance, I'm shooting it down. Her fake smile switched abruptly to an irritated scowl, and she turned to look off camera. Of course we can shoot at it, Ken. Yes. No, I know this model of ship. Look at the safety regs. Here, let me. Her image flickered off and back on again, meanly triumphant. As port director, I have all the authority I need to deny landing to any vessel that I judge might be a hazard to the facility. Your hopped-up, hacked-together racer definitely qualifies. If you try to land anyway, well, I can't be held responsible for any rash acts my inferiors make. Her elbow jabbed sharply, hitting someone just off camera. Oh, hell, we couldn't turn around, even if we had the fuel to change course and the clearance to land back on Mars. We had nothing to go back to. Did Mom know that? Probably. We'd sold the homestead on Mars for the ship. Packing this cargo was going to pay for our fuel and landing on Earth. If Mom was angling for a bribe, she wasn't getting it. All we had to offer were cabbages and spare tubaroni. Dad didn't say that, though, because he's an idiot about these things. He said, please cite what rules or regulations we have violated, and we will make a good faith effort to address them. This was never going to work. Mom didn't respond to rules. I put my own fear on hold and deliberately pushed myself into frame in front of Dad. Hi, Mom. Her sneer twitched into an insincere smile. Junie, what are you doing there? Ugh. Her sweet voice made my skin crawl. Since you came to Claire, if I live or die, how about letting us land? Dad gripped the console with one hand and gently pushed me out of the way with the other. Through tight lips, he told me, don't engage, don't get personal. Oh, Mom said, it's personal. You are endangering my child in that. What even is that? The paper crane was built for the Earth-Moon races. Like Fleur, we got her cheap from people who wanted to throw her away. She had sleek lines for atmosphere and bright paint for looking pretty at the finish line, neither of which were useful going from Mars to Ceres, but she was airtight and she worked. Just tell me what we need to do, Dad said. Go back to Mars, Mom said, and cut the transmission. We hung there in the silence. Dad looked tired and scared. We can't go back to Mars, I said, because I was afraid Dad was about to go back to doing whatever Mom said, like she was the queen of outer space. No, we can't, Dad agreed. He poked the dash and pulled up a projection of our flight path. Most of the still dashed line that represented the bit left to go was inside the red circle of Ceres-controlled space. We had 20 minutes to come up with a new plan. This plan had taken all year. From the time Mom left, trashing the air filters in our habitat on her way out, we'd both had to work nonstop in the greenhouses. I'd had to squeeze my schoolwork between sleep and eating. If Grandma hadn't offered us a place back on Earth, We would have slowly starved if we hadn't found the buyer for the hab, if we hadn't found the ship, if we hadn't got to the shipping gig first. It was so much work and luck, and now I was seeing my dad, the guy who saved me, who once lifted a collapsing ceiling and held it for over an hour in the greenhouse, and he looked like he was about to fall apart. As for Mom, I didn't doubt she would fire on us. The sabotaging the air filters thing wasn't a one-off. Maybe send a lifeboat out for me as a gesture, if it didn't cost her. Is Mom like government of Ceres now or something? She's something, Dad muttered, which is close as I had ever heard him come to complaining about her. Would it kill him to be on my side just once? He had the Ceres Traffic Control FAQ open. There was Mom's name at the top, Director of Port Authority. Our little blip on the map inched closer to danger. Should we call her back? Offer her something? I hated saying it. Mom had sent random men so many times, demanding stuff after she left, naming rights on the baby, a share of the cabbage crop, me. There wasn't exactly a divorce court on Mars yet. Dad, had to fight and bargain every step of the way. Say you'll take her back, long enough to land. Dad's stern, anxious face turned to me in a moment of comic incredulity. Go check on the dog. Yeah, no, I wasn't about to run along and play when my life was on the line. Fleur was fine, grunting pig-like at something in the VR helmet, probably a simulated prey scent. Dad flicked through paragraphs of text, muttered more curse words, and opened a comms channel. The face that appeared wasn't Mom's. It was a lady I didn't recognize with deep wrinkles and narrow eyes. What is it? She snapped. You're almost due for hours. There's a problem with the landing. What? Your ship breakdown? I don't cover that. Oh, this was the buyer we were supposed to meet on Ceres. The miraculous benefactor who was willing to purchase our cabbages and had cargo to send with us to Earth. I broke in before Dad could waste time being all by the book about it. Port Authority says they'll shoot if we approach. She looked right at me, like she was unsurprised to talk to a teen, which I appreciated. What? That's ridiculous. What's the charge? Dad started to answer, but I spoke faster and louder. She's his ex. He gave me such a look. The woman's eyes widened. Then she looked delighted. Times change. Humans don't, huh? Sell the ship to me. She'll have no reason to block my ship, huh? I own half the planet. I'm sending you a deed of sale. She was tapping furiously at her console. Take 40% off my share of the cargo going to Earth. That was a shitty price. Won't that interfere with, like, docking on Earth? I asked quietly. It wasn't really a question. If we didn't own the ship, we'd have to keep asking this lady for permission to use it to get the licenses. Never mind that being a cargo ship team was our whole plan. How would we make money without the ship? Were we just going to live off Grandma on Earth? Dad was watching the countdown to Ceres space. His jaw worked and he wouldn't look at me. Less than 10 minutes now. We can't do this, I said. Neither of them acknowledged I'd spoken. Dad's eyes were hard and focused. I couldn't imagine seeing that glare and not backing down. Was this woman immune to fear? Or was it the distance? Either way, she just looked bored. His jaw stilled. Oh no, that was the blank, resigned look he got before he went and gave in on one of Mom's crazy demands that only she was allowed to use the radio, or that he had to sleep in the greenhouse. He reached for the controls. I beat him, snapping the line closed. Dad reeled. In zero-G, emotion can really throw you. He smacked the ceiling so hard, Something snapped inside it. He jabbed his finger at me. You don't do that. You don't cut me off while I'm talking. Dad looked scary mad, but I held tight to my handhold and glared right back at him. Mom wouldn't even look at the bill of sale. Think. I'm the adult. You are the child, he said for the zillionth time. It's what he said when he knew I was right, or when he'd go without food so I could eat. I didn't like either use. He hit the comms button way too hard, so the button squeaked. We watched the receiving, not responding, light blink and blink. Another minute wasted. Finally, a man's voice appeared. He'd only glance into the camera in quick flashes, like he was afraid to meet our eyes. Look, the port director left. She said not to talk to you. And, sorry, you should really go. The connection closed. Dad stared where it had been. I waited for my, you were right, Juno, it would have been stupid to sell our ship, so we couldn't even use that against Mom. 5 minutes now. Dad let out a long, slow breath. Do not talk on comms. There were times I could see why Mom was so nasty to him. I'm not a kid anymore. Don't I wish that were true? Dad glanced at me, disappointed, and I realized he thought he was alone in this, that it was all on him, and I wasn't there to help. I was one of the problems. I was right, though, I said. It never feels as good to say it yourself. For a long, awkward minute, the only sound was Flora's toenails tapping the treadmill and her soft, contented panting. What does she even want? I asked. More. Dad floated there, gaze miles away. It doesn't matter what she gets. She just wants more. Yeah. She'd fought and fought to prove I had to stay hers, even though she had no interest in spending time with me. It was just, I wanted to cry. I wanted to scream. I wanted the countdown to Ceres space to stop. 1 minute, 41 seconds. I took a deep breath. Are we dead now? Dad shook himself. Right. He started hitting controls. Lights turned off, the display map, the comm system display. He called up the autopilot and fed it new coordinates, then turned off that display too. He waved me back. Turn everything off, the heat, the treadmill, everything. We'll make ourselves hard to see. No light, no transponder, and change course. The crane can take a sharp deceleration. They won't expect that. We'll correct at the last second. He paused to look at me. Minerva's mean, but someone else will have to shoot, and that isn't a military base. We made ourselves hard to hit. They'll save their ammo. That didn't sound like the safest bet, but I knew better than to argue with Dad when he got that determined look. Fleur whined as I disconnected her VR. She nosed the helmet, trying to get it back on as I pulled it away. Her floppy ears unfolded to their usual zero-G upright flags. And no talking on comms, Dad shouted. I need to be able to trust you out here. Like I was going to call Mom? The gold slammed in hard after the heaters powered down. The three of us huddled in a thermal blanket, looking out the cockpit window. Ceres was so close now I could see veils of water vapor emissions tearing around her peaks, the stark craters untouched by habitat and rover, the smears of deposited salts. If I survived this, I'd write a poem. A poem about huddling in the dark with your dad and your dog, all three of you stinking and unwashed and cold, knowing that everything out there wanted to kill you. This was not how it will work. I had not imagined my father-daughter team up against the galaxy adventure would go like this. I also thought he'd yell at me a lot less. It'll work, Dad whispered now. and then his arms tightening around me like muscles would do anything to protect me. We were between Ceres and the sun now, our shadow racing us over her craters. When we got to the shade, we'd turn and turn everything on, too close to Doc for them to stop us, hopefully. Another squeeze. We moved right before going dark, and she wouldn't have been looking. It'll work. The one alert we left running, because it was the minimum for safety, started beeping. It was the proximity alarm. I froze. We were off course and not decelerating. Probably just a rock, Dad whispered. Floor whined and twisted in my arms to lick his face. Right on the stubble. Poor dog was going to die with a sore tongue. If I got out of this, I was not putting that in the poem. We were both waiting to hear something impact the hull. Your plans work, I said, willing it to be true. It'll work, like when you tricked Mom into leaving so we could call the marshal. He ducked his head, like getting a compliment hurt. Another long squeeze. You were a little right, he muttered, almost inaudible. Selling the ship went to work. You're a smart girl, Junie. The walls shuddered. You can't hear someone dock with your ship in the vacuum of space, but you can feel it. The jerk of it and the vibration through metal makes its own echo of a sound. At first, Dad tried to bundle me away from the airlock door and cover me and Floor with his body, but then he must have realized how stupid that was. Stay here, he said, and pushed off. The cold was painful when he left. The thermal blanket flipping open after him. I grabbed it and tucked it back around Floor, who wanted to stay with him, and made pleading whines, licking my neck and trying to kick free. Dad floated around the room, turning stuff back on. He pulled himself through the floor hatch, down to where he'd been repairing the coolant line, and came back with the largest wrench in the repair kit. He put his feet in a holding strap right in front of the door and twisted his white-knuckled fists around the wrench, raising it like a baseball bat ready to strike. That was his plan? I let go of Floor, who kicked over to Dad and licked the back of his neck. He flinched, then pretended he didn't feel it and kept his pose. There was a pry bar velcroed to the wall for emergency. I don't know, prying. I took it and flew to a handhold near Dad. He lowered his wrench and gaped at me. The fuck are you doing? I raised the pry bar, holding it higher on the right, same as he was with the wrench. Like, duh. Same as you. He shifted his shoulders and resumed his ready-for-flight stance. Get your ass back to the pilot's seat and stay hidden. Two idiots scowling with shitty weapons, infinitely more threatening than one. I can't believe you. This is your life. You have to listen. The bulkhead moved, and I was too scared to even be relieved. His lecture got interrupted. It was Mom. Of course it was, with undulating plastic behind her and the open outer door, a soft lock. Her helmet glass was foggy, but I could still see how smug she was, and that her bright coral lipstick had gotten on her teeth. It looked almost neon in the low-power capsule light. Junie, baby, put that down. You're coming with me. I wasn't as terrified as I expected to be. Part of it was that she looked less dangerous, sealed up in plastic and glass, and her movements were awkward. She wasn't used to zero-G. Dad looked at his pipe wrench like he didn't know what it was. So much for being a big, threatening man. You can't open the airlock like that, he gestured with the wrench underhanded, like it was a dustpan or something. Come all the way in and close the door if you want to talk. Mom, of course, stayed where she was, in the way of the inner airlock door. She knew what she was doing, making herself a failure point. It's perfectly safe. Perfectly safe. She hadn't risked her life without a pressure suit, just mine. Mom's smile strained as we didn't move. If you cared at all about our daughter, you'd step aside. "Junie, come." Fleur yipped, thinking that sharp command was meant for her, and swam over, tail wagging in her wake. Mom backed up, hands in front of her, to ward Fleur off. "Are you sick? What is that animal doing here? Are you breathing the same air? Ew!" I gently turned Fleur and pushed her back. I wouldn't trust that woman with a dog. Dad held up his hands, the wrench lying in the air beside him. "If Juno goes with you, will you make sure she's safe? Are you crazy? No, never." I grabbed hold of Dad's arm and pointed my pry bar at Mom. "I'll never go with you." Dad curled his arm, bringing me close. "Juno, you need to be safe. She's holding the airlock open and you don't have a suit on." Now, I was struggling out of Dad's grip like the dog she had been. "You can't let her win. Don't worry about me. Let her take you down to the surface." He spoke louder to Mom. "She needs to get to my mother's house on Earth. She's expected. Can you do that? Can you get her there?" I tightened my grip on my pry bar. "You need to trust me," I said. "I do," he said, his eyes shining. "Juno, I am trusting you with the most precious thing to me." He pulled me closer, whispering desperately, "There are other people on that ship. Find someone to protect you." That wasn't what I meant. I looked back at Fleur and then at Mom, who had her arms out like I was five and was going to jump into them. "Fleur," I shouted, "fetch." I threw the pry bar right at Mom, and Fleur threw after it. Mom screamed, dodging one but not the other. Fleur's paws skittered all over her face glass. The pry bar bounced on the ceiling of the airlock, but Mom was distracted enough I was able to hip check her and get to the manual override. I yanked the outer door closed and kicked off hard back to the main compartment, pushing Mom ahead of me. Fleur went along for the ride, fluttering around Mom's helmet, licking and whimpering. Dad, as I'd hoped, had gone to the interior controls. He closed the inner door as soon as we were clear. He gave me this shocked, impressed look. Slowly, Mom realized the dog wasn't her only problem. She stopped trying to bat Fleur away. She swung at me, but the suit made her clumsy. I dodged easily, grabbing a new hold on the ceiling. Fleur, sensing a threat, about time, growled, the dark hair around her neck fluffing out. "This is kidnapping," Mom shrieked. Dad slowly shook his head. "I guess so, Minerva, or we just resolved a criminal interference with our airlock in a way that kept everyone safe. You'll have to take that up with the nearest magistrate." "Oh, good one, Dad. Every nation and planet considered messing with airlocks a big crime." Mom kept circling her arms, trying to back up to the kitchenette. She was almost cute like this. "You small man, you were always jealous of me, always trying to keep me down. Well, the joke's on you because I'm free and I'm someone now. My crew will burn down that airlock to get me. Ken? Ken?" She turned away from us and held a hand to about where her ear was, like it would clear up her signal. "Ken, get me out of here." "No, just shoot it. You got it open once." Wow, did I wish I could hear Ken's side of this conversation. Dad swam up to Fleur, who gave him a quick look before continuing to growl at Mom. He fuffled the bristly hair on Fleur's back. "Juno, go to the controls. I watch our guest." I huffed. It was way more likely to hit back. "You need me here." "No," he turned and gave me a slight smile. "I need you to work the comms." Was he serious? I almost didn't hear the rest of his words. "Tell the other ship we'll get their port authority director to ground safely. They can see we're sound enough to land." "Yes, sir," I snapped a salute. "You'll need to run the landing, too," he said, his eyes serious and full of import. I didn't waste time talking. I kicked my way up to the navigation console. You always spoiled her, Mom said. It looked like Ken was already trying to signal us. I just had to accept the connection. He was a reedy man, all neck and no chin. Yeah, Ken said, sounding tired and looking embarrassed. I heard all that. I awkwardly pulled myself into the pilot's chair and fumbled for the restraints. I'm going to land us. Your boss is safe. My report will say that the soft lock failed, retracting it. He gave me a sober look. We'll put it down as a rescue. Before me, the nose of our ship glided over Ceres, close enough now, before the sharp peaks seemed to be reaching for us. The harness clicked into place, and I took the controls. We continue with Water Baby by Tanya R. Moore. At night, Niobe can hear them singing, the ghostly kinfolk inhabiting the sea. Their voices rise from the deep and swell like a chorus of baby whales threading the tremulous wind. Their eerie song makes her tremble. Her heart flutters. Her skin tingles. She can't tell whether the soft cry bubbling up and spilling force from her throat is constricting fear or maddening delight. Dawn arrives, driving a splinter into her fragmented dreams. A knock at her door registers. Ma Etoufe, the 40-something Himba neighbor with the froggy eyes and thick-rimmed spectacles, brings a ratty basket piled with eggs from the communal chicken coop. The older woman hands it over, watching Niobe curiously as she doles out what's bound to be devastating news. The Lopez and Singh families left in the middle of the night. The rest of the Montoyas, too. The whole lot of them boarded the Coast Guard boat headed for the mainland. Niobe is still sleep-addled, still clad in her itchy-sleeved flannel pajamas. She veers into full wakefulness after a few seconds. Ma Etoufe's words sink in. Niobe curses under breath. Cowards, she scowls, the whole lot scurrying away from Calypso like thieves in the night. They could have at least talked it over with her. Not that it would have mattered. Not that how anyone felt about this whole mess would have changed. She kisses her teeth, but then she remembers her manners. She nods her thanks for the eggs. All right, heart slowly sinking, she tells the older woman. I'll remove them from the community registry. Niobe makes breakfast for two on autopilot. Eggs from Ma Etoufe and catfish fresh from the night traps. She's at her mother's bedroom door, arm poised to knock softly when she realizes her mistake. She waits a beat before opening the door. Her mother isn't there. Charlene's bed is empty and neatly made. Niobe glances over at the desk by the window. Her mother's laptop is still plugged into the solar-powered charger, power battery indicator silently blinking green. 2 months. A strangled little whimper sticks in Niobe's throat. Niobe's mother was the first of the submerged village's residents to vanish. Charlene had left in her canoe to check on Calypso's shut-in residence one morning and never returned. Niobe rose around Calypso searching day after day to no avail. Her hope that her mother is somehow safe and sound is being steadily eaten away by the disappointment and dread creeping into her gut. Niobe straightens, drawing in a deep, shuddering breath. She swipes at her stinging eyes with her tightly fisted knuckles. Resolute, she closes her mother's bedroom door. Mid-morning, Niobe's canoe slices through the brackish waters of Calypso's back alleys. She repeats the arduous task of dipping her long paddle into the murky wet, one side, then the other, one side, then the other. Beads of sweat drip from her hairline to her brows, the salty wetness stinging her eyes and trickling down her glistening neck to the valley between her breasts. The cloying humidity intensifies as cumulonimbus clouds gather, obscuring the sun's merciless gaze. The indolent breeze echoes their empty promises of rain. She hums a wordless tune as the canoe glides past tall, silent buildings, half submerged in the seawater and entangled in mangroves and hairy sargasso. A month ago, these waterways were full of life, crowded with canoes, people, music, and a floating market where you could buy anything from alligator limbs to water distillers. Niobe longs for that noisy energy, the mishmash of language, music, flavors, the laughter, the chatter, the shrieks of raucous vendors hawking their shady wares. The silence is heavy, but Niobe knows the buildings aren't empty. She can't see them, but she can feel the furtive stares of the people living inside the semi-submerged structures, the ones who've yet to flee or be taken. Her brown brows crinkle, betraying her impatience. Her short dreadlocks quiver as she turns to cup her mouth and yells, "You can't live on the water yet fear the sea." No one comes outside. No one responds to her taunt. They're afraid. They're afraid for Niobe. They're afraid for themselves. Everyone knows by now. Something lurks deep within Calypso's waters. Something that makes people disappear. Doc Mali lives on the top floor of what was once the Yemanja Holistic Treatment Center. There are two towers. Sea moss carpets the outer walls of the towers protruding from the water. A grand solarium dominates the east tower. The west tower houses many rooms, and this is where Doc Mali lives, plies her medicinal crafts, and consults her witchery bag of bones. Niobe rows towards the east tower. She sets a small package onto the balcony before hopping out of the boat. She ties the grab loop to one of the cement banisters before scooping up the package and entering the solarium. Beautiful chaos reigns inside. Blooming lotus, papyrus, and lily pads vie for breathing round inside an above-ground pond. Pots bearing a multitude of medicinal plants, herbs, and vegetables crown the shelves lining the walls and multi-tiered planters hanging from the metal beams reinforcing the glass ceiling. The lush clash of scents is intoxicating. Niobe sets her packaging down and grabs a large watering can. She goes to the cylindrical contraption squatting in one corner of the balcony. She cranks the lever on the device. The distiller's yellow suction hose gulps seawater from below. The green output hose spits fresh water into the watering can. Niobe waters the plants, then returns the watering can. She picks up her package. Crossing the bridge between towers, she sets foot into the old witch's abode. It's warm inside her mentor's workroom. It smells like earthy spice and herbs. Dried bunches of rosemary, chamomile, sage, and lavender hang from the ceiling. Doc sits at her work table, her long white dreadlocks gathered into a loose ponytail frame her oval face. Her bright yellow tunic blazes in contrast to her nutmeg skin. Her long, slender fingers curl around the pestle she's using to grind dried roots in her mortar. Beads of sweat drip from her wrinkled brow. She hums lowly, her mouth twisted into a wry ghost of a smile. "Morning, Doc," Niobe sets the package onto the table before her elder. Fried green plantains, and she jerks her head in the general direction of the east tower. I've watered your plants. Thanks for saving me the trouble, Doc says with a toothy grin. And thanks for the plantains, child. Doc sets the pestle into the mortar and picks up her stethoscope. Her wheelchair emits a soft whir as she navigates around the table. She brings it to a stop in front of Niobe. Doc eyes the younger woman critically. She pretends not to notice the way Niobe's eyes fixate on the witchery bag tied to her belt, resting in her lap. You're looking a bit blue, Doc says. Let me see. Niobe holds out her hand, shivering slightly as Doc examines the spaces between her fingers and traces the pattern of the veins on the back of her hand. Take off your blouse, Doc commands. Niobe obeys. She hugs the back of the chair and leans forward so that Doc can get a good look at her back. She trembles as Doc's fingers trace a line down the left side of her spine, then up the right. The skin there is welted, forming two ridges on Niobe's back. Feel that? Doc asks. Yeah. Does it hurt? Doc probes. No, answers Niobe. Just kind of prickles and feels like there's something icky stuck to my back. Didn't your ma know anything about this? Niobe shrugs, trying to sound tough. It didn't start till she upped and disappeared. I'll apply another poultice. Doc purses her lips and eases back in her wheelchair as Niobe puts her blouse back on, then returns the chair to its rightful place. She eyes Niobe intently. You really have no idea what's causing this? Niobe shrugs and swiftly changes the subject. I came to see if you'll teach me, Doc. Will you teach me how to rattle the bones? Late night comes, and Niobe can hear sea folk singing again. In her mind's eye, she can see them, dolphin-skinned humanoid creatures frolicking in the moonlight as they slip between curtains of Sargasso in the murky sea. Their song is woeful and frantic. It fills her mouth and floods the gates of her brain. Something is wrong, she can tell. Something is terribly, terribly wrong, but Niobe doesn't understand what. In her bed, she burrows deeper under the covers and squeezes her eyes shut, sternly willing her tense muscles to relax. When she finally drifts off to sleep, she dreams of her mother's body submerged in black water, hair limp, eyes hollow and devoid of life. Niobe awakens with a start. Her shoulders shake, her lips quiver. She weeps inconsolably in the dark. Come morning, Ma Etoufe sets out for the mainland. This village is done for. The older woman's fingers curl around Niobe's upper arm. Your ma, our mayor, is missing. Everyone's leaving. Come with me, pleads Ma Etoufe. My daughter can help us both get a fresh start on the mainland. Niobe can't give a name to the emotion raging inside her. It's hot, scalding, and violent. Honestly, she's tempted to punch the older woman in the face for even suggesting such a thing. But Ma Etoufe's done nothing to deserve that. Instead, she gently extricates herself from the kind woman's grasp. I'm not leaving this place, not until I find my ma. Maybe the sea knows best. Life once crawled up out of the ocean. Maybe the sea is simply taking back its own. Ma Etoufe lightly pats Niobe's cheek. Take care. The older woman gathers up her bags and departs without ever looking back. Days pass. The remaining denizens of Calypso either flee to the village or disappear. The mainland looms ominously, uncharted and incomprehensible territory. When not out on the water searching, Niobe spends her time on her mother's laptop learning about the world beyond Calypso. Nothing she learns makes her feel in any way inclined to become a part of that scene. She longs for the days when Calypso was bustling with people and their noise, music, and laughter. She longs for her mother's easygoing, comforting presence. She longs for the salty wetness of the deep blue sea. Niobe tethers her boat to the rotting escalator railing of Doc Molly's building. Her nerves jangly with determination and anticipation, she takes the stairs up to the bridge between towers, two at a time. Today's the day, she's decided. The old witch is going to teach her how to consult the bones. Today, come hell or high water. She crosses the threshold to Doc's workroom. She stops, uneasiness tightening into a fist inside her chest. Doc, she calls out, are you here? She notices Doc's empty wheelchair upended behind the work table. Unnerved, she approaches the work table. Her gaze swoops down to a thick booklet stuffed with old newspaper clippings. She picks up a clipping. It's over 100 years old, from a few years after the floodwaters swallowed the peninsula once known as Florida. The article features a hazy photo of two women, survivors of the epic disaster. Niobe recognizes a much younger Doc Molly. Then her blood runs cold. The other woman in the photo is her own mother, Charlene, and she doesn't seem to have aged a day in over a century. The sound of movement from the doorway startles Niobe. The clipping slips from her fingers, fluttering to the floor as her gaze clashes with Doc Martin's bemused stare. A tied handkerchief covers Doc Molly's mouth and nose. Her right arm is held high, a smoking censer swinging from her curled fingers. Doc, what's going on? Niobe doesn't get to finish her question. Her tongue suddenly thickens, swelling up inside her mouth. Her strangled breath hitches on the aroma of whatever's burning, sage, parsley, something that smells like the burning body of a peony wally that flies too close to a halogen lamp. Her brain is still processing this as the room tilts and her body hits the floor. Darkness slams down, eclipsing her mind. Niobe awakens. She's sitting on an old wooden chair, semi-submerged in brackish water. She tries to move, but her hands and feet have been bound with thick ropes. I wouldn't do that if I were you, Doc Malley's gravelly voice comes from across the room. It reacts to movement. That's how it locates prey. I can't guarantee it wouldn't hunt even you. Niobe's head turns. She eyes the older woman, who stands hunched in a far corner, occupying the closest dry spot on the downward sloping floor. Parking garage? Niobe briefly wonders how quickly switches gears. Right now, she's got bigger fish to fry. Doc Molly is no longer holding the smoking censer. Instead, she cradles a large jar filled with something dark Niobe can't quite make out under one arm. The jar emits a low thrumming sound, like a drumbeat punctuating the stagnant air. Niobe swallows the growing unease clogging her throat and makes a half-hearted stab at sounding nonchalant. What's up, Doc? Doc Molly snorts derisively. She puts her thumb and forefinger in her mouth and blows. An ear-splitting whistle fills the air, the echoes reverberating throughout the lower reaches of the tower. The black water at the deeper end surges. In the poor light, Niobe's narrowed eyes make out the shape of something rising up from the murky wet, seaweed-like snarls of drenched black hair, a gray, bluish, human-like forehead, eyes aglitter with quicksilver sclera, and inky irises fixate warily on the spot where Doc Molly stands. The creature opens its maw, emitting an agitated, inhuman squeal. Niobe catches a glimpse of a mouthful of raggedy teeth. As the creature draws closer, a prescient kind of instinct sends a shudder of recognition shooting down her spine. Her eyes start stinging, and that lump in her throat surges back upwards with a vengeance, raw and cutting, like the crude edge of an old knife. "No," she whispers tremulously, with a convulsive shake of her head. "Please, God, no." "You catch on so quickly," Doc delivers a sinister snicker before sobering, then sounding almost regretful. "I always liked that about you." "Ma!" Niobe cries out, beseeching eyes following the creature as it treads the water of the surface, back and forth, back and forth, its ravenous glaze sharpened by a predatory intelligence, cuts Niobe to the quick. It betrays no sign that it knows her, not like a mother ought to know her daughter. Instead, it sees only prey. Niobe's heart cracks, and she can feel it splintering into a thousand pieces as a new kind of fear begins clawing its way into her gut. "What did you do to my ma?" Niobe spits confused betrayal and venom. "What the hell did you do?" "Look at me," Doc Molly says, removing her face covering. "I don't look a day over 40, and I no longer even need that infernal wheelchair." Niobe stares wordlessly at her mentor. Doc Molly, looking decades younger than she did only days ago, makes a tss sound with her tongue and teeth. She seems oddly let down by the fact that Niobe doesn't understand. "It's blood," Doc Molly says, a guttural laugh erupting from deep inside her throat. "If simply drinking its blood does all this, can you even imagine what eating this flesh might do?" She holds the jar up in the air, and in the dim light, Niobe can finally see what's inside. Suspending in clear liquid, the sea creature still beating heart. Niobe's stomach turns. The creature in the water reacts violently, squealing and thrashing about. Doc Molly laughs, and she laughs the hideous sound, making Niobe's blood boil and boil. "It stays close because I have its heart," the older woman grins. "I feed it a regular supply of human flesh, and being of use to me gives meaning to its existence. What more could it possibly want?" Something inside Niobe's soul breaks with an almost audible snap. She doesn't remember ripping her way out of the ropes or upending the wooden chair, but the next thing she knows, propelled by blind rage and grief, she has both hands grabbing and squeezing Doc Molly's scrawny neck. Gagging and choking, the old woman loses her grasp on the jar. Its thick glass cracks as it hits the ground and rolls down the concrete surface and into the water. Wild-eyed, Doc Molly shoves Niobe aside and lunges after the jar. Niobe loses her balance and lands on her ass in the water. The pain barely registers. Doc Molly flails wildly in the frothing water, screaming in agony, and the creature bites into flesh, breaking bone and dragging her down into the water. The murk turns a cloudy crimson, swallowing Doc Molly's screams in a single gulp. In the jarring silence that follows, Niobe can only sit there in the water, heaving and trembling, while bawling wordlessly as the creature that was once her mother resurfaces, clutching the broken jar containing its heart close to the chest. It eyes Niobe watchfully, and Niobe isn't sure whether she only imagines the nearly imperceptible nod it gives her before retreating into the deep, dark, wet. A warm breeze buffets the air as the sun goes down, and darkness begins to blanket the deserted corpse of Calypso. Listless, Niobe slowly rows homeward, swamped by the sad certainty that there won't be anyone waiting for her there. The sea folk, they come out again at night. Song no longer frantic, they call Niobe to the deep. This time, she shucks off her pajamas and takes the stairwell down to the 13th floor. She dives head first into the brackish water. She is welcomed by a high-pitched, inhuman squeal. Niobe follows the sound. She swims out of the building, down the street, and dives into the depths of the wide open sea. She never looks back. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.